In the third year of law school, in those days, we generally looked for jobs. And one of my teachers then was Felix Frankfurter, and we were rather close, and I told him I was looking for a job, and I told him that I was planning to go to Cincinnati, and that I had an appointment there. He said, well, come see me afterwards. So I went to Cincinnati, got a job at Dinsmore, Scholl, Sawyer, and Dinsmore. Even at this remove, I remember, it was all worked out. Came back, told Felix that I had a job, and he said, well, that's great. Why don't you take 1 year off and go to Washington? It sounded good to me because FDR was then active in speaking, and I called Judge Scholl. He said, fine, we need someone with a Washington background, and we'll certainly give you the year off. So I came back and finished the year at the law school. And in midsummer of 35, I went to Washington with a friend, David Hexter, who was also at the SEC then. He was going to an engagement party and said that I was welcome to come along. And the engagement party was Abe Fortas.
Oh.
At that time, Abe Fortas and Carol were getting married. And there I met a number of friends of Abe and of Hector's, and little by little came to know a group. That was in the midsummer. Took the bar exam in West Virginia, and then early in September, or the end of August, I came to Washington and there met Joe Rao, a classmate. Joe and I had been very close friends in law school and have remained so throughout our lives. Joe and I were both sent, as arranged by Frankfurter, to the SEC. We had some discussions about it, and both of us felt that this was an emerging agency. It was just growing, just being born, and thought it would be interesting to see it from the beginning. I remember we came here. Joe Kennedy was still the head of the SEC, but was just about to leave. He had been handling the 33 Act at the Federal Trade Commission. And the Federal Trade Commission, this is kind of a footnote, had completed by then 75 volumes of hearings. It was an immense series on public utility holding companies. And that had been the basis of hearings and...
Who had headed up that study at the FTC?
I don't know the name of the man. I had never met him. I never met anyone at that time at the Federal Trade Commission. But we did know about those hearings and followed them. So we began work at the SEC. Joe's wife had a baby in that first month, and that took time from all of us. But the work at the SEC, I was assigned to the general counsel's office, John Burns, I believe was the name.
General counsel.
And I was assigned to work with a man named, and because of his name I remember it so well, Isaac Newton Phelps Stokes III. An immensely bright, able fellow. And he supervised the preparation of opinions. Because of the new legislation, we had the 33 Act on the books. SEC was created under the 34 Act legislation. So that, and the 35 legislation was in the Senate, I think, at the time. And we expected it to come out. You can imagine what the New York Bar was doing. It was writing letters saying, what does this mean? This sentence or that sentence or this act on. Not many facts, but asking nevertheless opinions without cases. Most of those we mailed back. But as facts emerged, as the cases developed, we were flooded with inquiries from not only New York, of course, but Chicago and elsewhere throughout the country, so that we were very busy. Second, Ike Stokes was a craftsman in English. He wrote very careful and wonderfully clear opinion letters. And I assume that's why he had been appointed to that role. And he was a marvelous tutor. And that, for me, became a lifelong interest. I've taught writing for lawyers in my own office for years, and I'm presently doing so. So that it's one debt that I owe the SEC from that beginning.
You said opinion letters. What were these opinion letters? Formal interpretations of the statute?
Interpretation primarily, but we insisted as applied to certain facts. And what we had to be careful about was that the lawyers were carefully asking questions that would assist them in achieving certain collateral objectives.
You said the legislation was then pending in the Senate. Did you participate in any of the legislative efforts, or are you aware by anecdotes or otherwise who were the people who were active in getting that legislation through the Congress?
Yes. Mostly as a messenger, though. That's when I first met Justice Black, Senator Black then. And I remember being sent to the Senate with a message or information for Senator Black by Tom Corcoran. Very early, Burns actually called me and said that from time to time they were going to assign me to Tom Corcoran and Ben Cohen, who were two basically and seemingly to me at the time independent operators, not part of the SEC, but operating fundamentally out of the White House. And so I must say that probably the bulk of my time between 45 when I first
35
35 when I first came in and really 39, middle of 39, was spent with them in their offices. A lot of the time was spent on the litigation having to do with the constitutional validity of the 35 Act, which was passed by narrow margins. And so I continued work at the commission until within about a month or two. I was asked to go over to Ben Cohen's office and met him, liked him. For me, he proved to be the wisest man that ever entered my life. Tom Corcoran was a marvelously interesting, convivial, pleasant, joyful Irishman who had the very best of brains, and together he and Ben served the country in extraordinarily many ways, and always well.
Do you perhaps recollect any stories that you picked up of their relationships with the White House in pushing the legislation? Because they had worked on both the 33 and 34 Act before they got to the 35 Act.
I came at the end of the consideration of the 35 Act, so that my ties at the time to the legislation were not strong, and indeed at present time dim, so that I have almost no recollection of that kind of thing.
Do you recall the strategy that the commission used determining what case to take up to the Supreme Court on the constitutionality?
Yeah, that brings a story to mind that may be of interest to you. The first area of the Act, of the 35 Act that was being challenged, were naturally the registration provisions. The company didn't want to register. Tax the registration. We were defending on the ground that what danger was there in registration, and how were you going to suffer? John W. Davis in New York represented a dentist in Baltimore was involved in the Burko case, B-U-R-C-O. That was, I think, the first case that came up. Ben had been a lawyer in New York, but he had been a lawyer's lawyer. When lawyers had too much trouble with their problems, they called Ben in, and he was consulted. He was a very bright fellow. He had been he had received his degree in law in Chicago, did an advanced degree at Harvard, and had served Judge Mack in New York as a law clerk, and then had gone back to New York to practice. You've got to bring me back to what I've just forgotten.
You were talking about the Burko case?
Burko case, yes. When the Burko case began, and neither Tom nor Ben, so far as I know, and they may have done so, but there was no indication of it, entered a courtroom. And they had that case that was coming up, and the papers from the case. And so they needed somebody who could practice in a court, try a case. And so they had a young lawyer here in town, recruited him, just not in the government at that time, and he tried the case. It was simply a motion to dismiss on the ground of no issue at that time. And we won it. This was the beginning of a piece of legislation that lasted perhaps 2 years. And that was Dean Acheson.
Oh.
From Sullivan and Cromwell. From
Huntington?
Yes. And that was the first time I had met him. But it was, he did a good job. The judge joined with us, and everything was fine. Now, now you've got to bring me back to what you want to pursue.
The strategy after that case in defeating the efforts to declare the statute unconstitutional.
That was the beginning of an effort that lasted until 38. During that period, I spent probably most of my time with Ben and Tom working on the litigation. Justice Department was involved in it, of course. And
do you recall who the lead person was in handling that strategy in the litigation?
I never knew in terms of who was taking the lead, but I know from what was written in the final analysis that most of it was Ben's. Bob Jackson was then the Solicitor General, and we saw a lot of him.
Do you recall, David, who argued the case in the Supreme Court for the government?
Unforgettable for me. Bob Jackson was one, and Ben was the other. We were at the court, and I was sitting with them. And Ben, who had been preparing endlessly for the argument, was there alone. Bob was late showing up. You can imagine Ben had been up since 5 o'clock rehearsing. So we were sitting down there in formal clothes. He was there in formal clothes. And Bob showed up about 2 minutes before the court came in. And we were relieved that he showed up. But he made a good argument. He spoke first, and then Ben took the latter half. Ben took the hard part. And it all went well, as you know, finally. But that was after lots of litigation in the district court, in the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit in New York, and then finally up. The chosen case was Electric Bond and Share case.
Was there some special reason that that was chosen?
It was big, diversified, presented virtually all of the issues that we wanted to raise in the initial phase of litigation.
Did the challenges have any real basis for attacking the constitutionality, in your view?
They thought so.
What was the view in the commission and the government? Were you concerned that this raised very novel issues?
No, it wasn't that. It was one of the issues that we learned about in Frankfurter's court, in Frankfurter's last year class. There's no concrete issue. basically the same issue as raised on registration, but was much broader. Now, we needed facts. And so there was a team of five or six people working up in New York, getting the facts about Electric Barn Cherry, working with the company, basically to try to agree on the facts. And we did very much. Very few differences of any kind. And there was a team up here seeking to integrate the information into the briefs and the preparation of the materials for the court.
Do you happen to recall which issues the challenges were particularly focusing on and attacking as raising constitutional issues that merited the Supreme Court to declare it unconstitutional?
It's too far away.
Too far away. Okay. Do you know whether President Roosevelt at all during this period showed any interest in the litigation or in talking to...
I can't tell about that.
You don't know about that. Did you ever go to the White House with them?
Yes, but not with Ben or Tom. From time to time, I was shunted around also to Judge Rosenman.
Oh, yes. He was the counsel to the president.
Counsel for the president. But he wasn't here all the time. He was up in New York and then in Washington. And I assisted him sometime on research for the speeches that he was basically the prime speech preparer for the president. But there were others who worked, and of course others who contributed. But the president looked to him for...
How did you at the SEC become a participant in that, since it was really a White House function?
Of course. The SEC then, as now, not only the SEC, but other agencies and departments of the government, lend people to the White House as needed. The staff of the White House at that time was almost non-existent. There were no assistants to the president, there were no staff. What is now the annex, an annex, that enormous building on 18th and Pennsylvania Avenue, was had been occupied by the State Department and by the War Department, the State Department, by the State Department. And no members of the White House were in it. Now it's occupied entirely by it.
Did you ever have any personal conversations with the president?
Yes, I did. Not personal conversations, certainly not. But I accompanied Sam when we went to talk with him, and did so.
Did he have a... active participation in the speeches that were being prepared by...
Only by contributing research that Sam assigned to me to check. And that's what I did.
When you were there with Roosevelt, did the president have participation with him? And
oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
And lots of exchange. Indeed, often, the president came in with notes of the kinds of things he wanted to say, and he would outline it for Sam, and there would be some discussion between them.
Did any of these relate to the support of the securities legislation?
Not so far as I'm aware, no recollection. I don't think the president ever made a reference to the SEC.
With Cohen and Corcoran, what was their relationship as individuals to each other? Were they
warm,
compatible, warm, friendly?
Intimate, as closer than brothers, and treated each other with the utmost respect. Tom was a more skillful writer, in my view, than Ben. But Ben was much more, but not totally. Tom contributed to basic ideas as well. But Ben really shaped what emerged and was the dominant intellectual force, in my view, in that team. I remember the time when Time magazine had their pictures on the men of the year or something of that sort. And Tom was much more the hatchet fellow. When the president had something to do on the Hill that no one liked, Tom was the man who delivered the word and carried the hatchet.
Were there any particular people in the Congress who were supportive of the SEC's programs that you remember?
I don't recall. I'm sure they were.
After the constitutionality of the Act was affirmed, there was a question of implementation of the provisions of that Act. My recollection is that there was a substantial move under Section 11E, the voluntary reorganization provision.
That's correct.
To do it. Do you have any recollection of how that worked and how the Commission was successful in pushing the companies to reorganize voluntarily?
Well, I couldn't have, because in the latter part of, I was at that time, after the decision, back at the SEC, and I became an assistant to to Bill Douglas, and that lasted for a while. Worked very closely with him, primarily on opinions and drafting opinions, and so that I was out of contact with all of the others at that time.
Was Douglas then the chairman at that point?
Well, Douglas came on before he was chairman.
Yes.
1 year, I think.
Yes.
And he had been in charge of something called the Protective Committee study.
Right. That's correct.
And he was made chairman after Landis withdrew and then took over. This was, must have been late 38, but I don't remember the day.
Working for Douglas.
So I was working with Douglas.
Yes.
I was the administrative assistant or something. I don't remember the title.
How was he to work for?
Complex. He tended not to explain precisely what he wanted. We were very close, and he spoke freely with me and all of that. But I never was absolutely sure, given something to do. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but I was rarely had clearly in mind what it is that he wanted done or how. But I provided drafts. I'm now talking of memos or opinions of what I thought he had, and he would go over it and tell me if he differed, then I revised. But
was he easy to work with, though? Or was he a difficult challenger?
Patient. He was a teacher. You must remember he had taught for years, both at Columbia but largely at Yale. and that had the Abe Fortas now with him from Yale. And so he had a very good contact also, a very good relationship with Jerome Frank, who came on to the commission about that time.
What were these, do you recall the subject matters that you were dealing with in writing these memos for Douglas? Opinions?
Well, no. I have no recollection of it.
Now, the study that Douglas did, was that the forerunner for the bankruptcy chapter 10?
Of the protective committee? Less in the sense of bankruptcy, and much more in the sense of telling him what actually happened. He was providing the basis for some rethinking, but not talking about the change in the bankruptcy law at that point.
When he became chairman, did you still work with him?
Yes, for quite a while, until Leon Henderson came on the commission. He was new. He had been the economic advisor to the National Democratic Committee, and he came on as an economist, but one without much background about the SDC. And in a sense, I was assigned then to him as an assistant to help him or help orient him through the commission. And that's what I did. I liked him. We got along well.
What was the relationship among the commissioners and Douglas at the time he became chairman?
Well, you have to take the commissioners with Leon.
Leon and the others, Frank.
Oh, and the others. Oh, I thought it was good. I attended some of their meetings. There was never any...
What were the big issues that they were considering, do you remember?
Well, I can tell you an anecdote, a story that illustrates some of the problems that can come up. We were dealing with, I think, it was the Consumers Power Company case. Had to do with how bonds, the relationship between the banks and the issuance of bonds. The problem was that compensation and fees and so on were never fully exposed. The commission, all members of the commission, thought that there should be open for bidding. And they weren't at the time. And there was corruption. We had evidence of it. I think it was Jerome Frank, that's what brought it to mind, who did a draft of the opinion. And it was long. I don't know, 100 pages, 120 pages. And Douglas called me in and said, do what you can to shorten it. And I must have spent several weeks on that. And I had it down to perhaps 20 pages. A lot of this is very vague in my mind. I don't want to overstate it. But I do recall the final meeting with Jerry. Came in with this summary, I mean, summary, restatement of his opinion. And he read it, and he slapped me on the back and said, "Boy, that's great. We'll put it in as a summary at the end of the opinion." I don't know what finally happened on this thing, but they worked it out. They used parts and didn't use parts.
When you were at a commission meeting, was there a very open discussion of the issues?
Yes.
And was there any times when the White House might have sent over something that they were interested in that the commission might have taken up?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to your knowledge. Do you remember any political influence that people may have attempted to exert, either the public utility holding companies or others?
If there was, I was not privy to it.
You mentioned Jerry Frank. You mentioned Landis. Did you have much to do with Landis?
I knew Landis well, and later on came to when he became a dean at the law school, I saw more, even more of him. But Landis was a more restrained person. I didn't feel that I got to know him as well as others on the committee.
Did you have much to do with Abe Fortas?
Abe was a personal friend, and I saw a lot of him.
Did you work with him at all on things?
Yes, when the Holding Company Act was organized, and they set up the Holding Company they had a Holding Company division. I've forgotten the name of the fellow. Public Utility Division. And then Abe became either his number two, because he wasn't very good, the top man. And so Abe came in, was put in. I don't know.
Who was the number one man? Do you remember?
I don't remember the name. Okay. It begins with a G, Golding or something like that. It was not a name that has remained, at least in my mind. And I did work with Abe, under Abe.
Was Roger Forster there at that time?
Roger was there.
At that time.
Bright fellow.
Yeah.
And not particularly effective, but able, intelligent, worked hard, and liked him very much.
Was Louis Loss there at that time?
Louis came there toward the end. And
How about Milt Freeman?
Milt Freeman I knew at the commission. He died recently, as you know.
Yes. Did you have much to do with him in the commission?
We were friends.
That's all.
Went out together and so on.
How about Milton Cohen?
Milton Cohen, we were friends throughout his life. He went to Chicago and practiced. And
was Milton then in the public utility division, or was he somewhere else? Do you recall?
I don't recall.
No recall. And was Kroll there, Milton Kroll?
Milton Kroll, I knew him from way back.
From West Virginia?
West Virginia. When he came in, when he came to West Virginia, I was in my senior year. And at a fraternity house, and I saw him and recruited him for the fraternity.
And how did he get to the SEC through you or not?
What?
Did he go to the SEC through you or separately?
I don't recall. I think I wrote a letter, but I don't remember. I knew Milton very well, and see him and his son. His son is now working on the Hill.
Yes, I know. We gave you some questions before we met, and you made some notes. It would be helpful now if you just concentrated on the thoughts that you recorded in preparation for your interview. Are we running on the tape?
Why don't I stop?
Hold for a second, David.
I remember thinking when I first came to the SEC how well I could live on the compensation then being paid. And there was no question that at that time, the pricing situation was very good. I was getting $100 a month, $1,200 a year when I first came in. It moved up, but never to any great extent.
Were you able on that to live alone, or did you share apartment space with others?
One, I wouldn't want to have lived alone, but two, we shared.
Who was your roommate?
Oh, no, I went into a house.
Oh.
1718 Q Street. I have some of these senior moments now.
Were they SEC people?
No. Mostly Solicitor General.
Oh.
People whom I knew from there. Paul.
Paul Porter?
No.
Paul Porter?
No, not Paul Porter. Although he came in later. He taught at Harvard for years in the constitutional law.
We'll get his name soon. Did these people that you roomed with have any contact with you at the SEC and your work or not?
Never.
No. Okay.
No, they had no. SEC was not only independent, but it was the agency in Washington, perhaps because of the Whitney case.
Did you participate in the Whitney case at all?
No. I knew that Douglas was hard at work, and so was Abe.
Abe Fortas?
Abe Fortas. And we met with them. When they had legal issues, they would turn them over for research and so on. But in terms of actually working on the case, not at all.
How big an office were you in those days? How many people did you have in the general counsel's office?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I can't even estimate. I think we were on the 10th floor, 17th in Pennsylvania, 18th in Pennsylvania. The building is now gone. And it was not large. I thought... I can't really...
What was the camaraderie of the commission as a whole? You mentioned it was the jewel agency in Washington. At the agency itself, what was the camaraderie?
At one point, an agency takes its tone, really, in my view, from the commissioners in many ways. Jim Landis was there, George Matthews, short, stubby, bright, able fellow, experienced in public utility matters. J.D. Ross, R.O.S.S. I don't remember his contribution. That doesn't mean he didn't make any. There was Bill Douglas at the time. And then Judge Haley from somewhere in New England. And he was a tall, gray, my own hair now, wonderful man in terms of character, straight, direct, effective when he spoke. I remember one time some of us were having lunch together. He happened to be in the group. And he pulled out of his pocket a paper that he had written a few days ago that he wanted to read to us. It had to do with the people, not the individual character, who went behind you in a traffic, blow the horn to have you move ahead. And we rolling on the floor with laughter, and you wouldn't expect it from him. But he had written his own essay on the kind of people, what their characters were, what they're likely to be at home. It was funny thing. It showed that degree of perversion in the person, so that we liked the members of the commission. Most of us, at least who were there from the beginning, called them by their first names, and they us. There was a closeness and a mutual respect, so that it worked out very well.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Being at the commission now, and I think it's probably a very different place than it was at its inception.
Well,
one of the questions I have is the relationship between the commissioners and the staff on a day-to-day basis. Did the commissioners get actively involved in the day-to-day work of the staff?
I'd say no. Another story comes to mind. One time when I was at the commission for maybe a couple months without break, without being having work, to work at Cohen and Corcoran, Jared Frank came to my office, sat down, and said, "Listen to this." And he had a book with him in his hand. He opened the book. It was a new biography of the old Roosevelt, the first
Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy. And it was eloquent and effective. The fellow has since written a second volume on this. And he was a hero of Jerry Frank. And he said, "God, see if you can't work it into my opinion." I was working on an opinion for him. So I said, "Fine, I'll take a look at it." And I was delighted to have the book, you know, to read. And then what he did, he sat with me and he ripped out those pages and gave them to me. And the whole notion of ripping out pages of a new volume for it. But he was that kind of a spontaneous and quick and responsive. So I cherished him. And indeed, we lived in the same apartment house.
You know, the first name and the collegiality that you mentioned continued in the commission all through my career as well.
It did.
Yeah, that was always the way. You could walk into anybody's office, junior.
That's correct.
And they would listen to you just like you were the most expert person in the world and give you such deference. Never try to put you down.
No.
It was a very collegial atmosphere. But go ahead.
That's curious. During that period, people were on the commission were such extraordinarily talented and really dynamic and strong-willed people. It must have been awfully difficult to get people like Landis and Douglas and Frank to sort of work together. They must have disagreed, didn't they?
They were smart enough to feel that they had to be working together. This was a period of time when the commission was very much needed. What had happened on the New York Stock Exchange, what had happened in the securities market, and the disaster that was occurring and worsening. This was a period when people were committing suicide and all of that kind of thing. There was sobriety in the country. And the commission reflected it. Some of these incidents are amusing. But those who were working here had some feeling that the product of their work was needed.
Certainly. I gather there was a feeling that the agency had a tremendous challenge to bring the country into some sort of stabilization or some sort of growth. in terms of the economy and the capital markets and that sort of stuff.
That's absolutely true. It's not that it has weighed on us, the responsibility, but we knew that this was important and that it had to get done and as fast as possible. So that when we finally had the 35 Act really in hand and the litigation was over, then my own involvement with the Commission began to be limited. I was working at the end of that period, as indicated before, with Douglas most of the time. Brandeis resigned from the court in January, I think, of 39. Lots of things were happening in Europe already. And the nominee, Ben and Tom, worked like dogs to push Douglas on the court. You know, it was the nine old men, and although one or two, there had been one, at least one change by then. And I had the feeling that he was going to get it. I remember going to Senator Borah. Senator Borah was a Westerner. It was essential that the West be represented on the court. Bill was a Westerner in origin, not really. He was born in Minnesota, and then he moved to West gradually with his parents, and then ended up in the northern part. And had spent most of his life in New York and Connecticut. So we got Borah to consider the problem. We don't know what the process was, at least I don't, but I remember speaking to him. And he got on the up in the Senate and made a speech of his ties to the West, of his interest in the West, of his commitment to the West. So, you know, you got the feeling that this man had budged from the city. So, and that took him over. Because with Borah, the Westerner, identifying with him. And so, I myself credit Borah with actually getting him on.
When you went with Douglas on the court, were you the only clerk that he had?
There was only
one clerk.
Only one clerk. In each member of the court, including the chief, had only one clerk.
Do you recall any matters that came up there that were related to the SEC that you have some recollection?
In my year, certainly not. I remember each opinion. He did every opinion and every word himself. Occasionally called on me for a memo. But the fact that we had known each other was a big help. He didn't know anything about the court either in terms of...
I understood from some stuff that I read that he used to sit at the... when they were having an oral argument and he'd be writing the opinion right there.
He made notes.
Oh.
I mean... But he, unlike the chief, there's stories about this, but he sent me up one day to see Hughes about something, and I think I was carrying an opinion that he was questioning. And I sat there, and I knew he was the secretary. She said, why don't you go in? He's at work now, but be quiet, and he'll finish. So I went in and sat down in the back of the room while this immensely impressive fellow dictated an opinion. There are other stories of this, but I saw it. He sat there when he had finished the fact part. Then he was moving into the law part, and then he was going to the combination part. And he had finished the facts, and he went all through that thing. It must have been a 15-page opinion. And he didn't stop. And then finished, and then we did our work, and went on. But he was an immensely impressive fellow. And Felix came on the court. Felix was on, actually, when Bill came on. And so, in a sense, they got along very well at the beginning. And then problems developed out of my problem. But the court was, of course, ruptured and in difficulties at the time. But they managed. Wendell Wilkin, I have to go for a moment. We were working on, he came on in April, in that summer, and we worked and worked throughout the year. And in the summer he had borrowed a place from the Secretary of Commerce, I've forgotten his name, on a little island in the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I went up with him and worked through the summer. We had received a lot of petitions for certiorari, and we had to deal with them. There are different arrangements now, but then every justice had to go over every petition. And so I was reading petitions all summer. And then toward the end of the summer, he told me that Thurman Auld and his wife were coming up. That was fine, I knew Thurman. And we were one night toward the end of the month, or really at the end of the month, sitting around a fire outside and talking, Thurman and his wife, Bill and myself. Suddenly Mildred, his then wife, his first wife, came running out of the house, came up to us and said that Germany has attacked Poland, screamed. And so we're all shocked and sat around talking. And I had all sorts of mixed emotions then as to what should be done, what I should do. Douglas had asked me to stay on for another period next month. And I really had the feeling at that point that we're going to be in the war. I had no idea when, but that it wouldn't be possible for the ally, for this country, to see the Germans take over the rest of Europe. And there was no indication that anybody could stop them at that point, where they were just walking practically over Poland with horses. And I remember the next morning, when after the Thurman and his wife left, that we spoke, and Bill was talking about the fall. I mean, when we get back, October and so on, the second Tuesday. And I said to him, if he could make the necessary arrangements, and it wouldn't discomfort him, then I'd like to get involved as soon as possible in the war effort. And he said, let me think about it, and I'll let you know today. He made telephone calls and so on. And then released me. So I went back, when I went back to Washington, I talked to Leon Henderson. There was then a commission, a joint commission of the Senate and the House and others included in it, a big one. After the 46th election,
36 or 46?
Big one.
46
election? I mean,
36.
36, right. When there had been so much really ugly stuff shunted against FDR. Particularly by the larger corporations and others in the country. I don't know who had the idea of this commission, and begin to re-examine the impact of the antitrust laws on American industry at the time. Had FDR faced the globalization we have today, and he gone crazy. But at that time, it seemed to him that the concentration of industry, which that was the, was getting to a dangerous point. So I talked to Blank with, and these were people who had some awareness of industry, some knowledge of it. Not in terms of detail of production, but roles, what they could do. And so after talking with Leon, we thought that we would get the chairman of the commission, could get the chairman of the commission, to consider converting it from an antitrust examination into preparation for war. And that's what we did. Omani, Senator Omani, I hold up.
Yeah. You made some notes. Have you given all the information that you made in your notes? Why don't you take a minute to just look at them and see what you can add?
Well, yes. And after that, I worked with a fellow named Leo Churn, and the man who became the head of the CIA for Reagan.
Bill Casey?
Bill Casey. Bill Casey, and
you worked with him back then?
Yeah. On legislation for the rearming of the country. And Bill, Leo, myself came up finally with a draft bill. And it was sent to the president. A couple days after he got it, he sent a message to the Hill saying that he was going to use a totally different piece of legislation that he remembered from World War I that we didn't even know anything about. And all that work, and it was intense for a period of months, was just gone.
Was this all done in secret, or did people know that you were working on this?
No, it was all quiet. I mean, it wasn't marked secret or anything, but we didn't. There was no publicity about it. And that required the country to set up really divisions of an organization. One representing labor, one representing consumers, one representing production, one representing manufacturing, one economic stability, and so on. Leon Henderson was appointed to take the economic stabilization role. And he asked me to come on as his counsel. So I joined that group. Under the Office of Emergency Management.
Do you have anything else in your notes, David, that you'd like to...
Oh, I have a lot of stuff that, personal stuff that I don't think has any great meaning here. I remember Milton Katz, Alan Troop, the second general counsel, David Saperstein, remember he was trading exchanges. What I remember most acutely was his attraction for the ladies. Harold Neff, Baldwin Bain, these are just names that I... Landis resigned September 37, yeah.
People have said that was a tremendous change for the commission because Landis's views of regulation were very different than Douglas's. That Douglas had much more of an activist, hands-on type of philosophy.
Well, Douglas had been involved with the Whitney case.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd seen it firsthand. And a lot of other things as a consequence of the Whitney case. I think it wasn't so much that there may have difference in personalities or attitudes as it wasn't aware of the conditions.
Did you have much relationship with Douglas after you left him over the years? Did you talk to him on occasion or frequently or not?
Very frequently, very closely. I was one of the counsel who defended him when they attempted impeachment when he was on the court. I saw a lot of him throughout his illness.
Did you, during that period, were there any SEC matters that resurfaced that you may have talked
None.
About with him?
None.
Okay. You have any other questions? Well, that's fine, David. You did a great job.
I'm delighted that this is... I wish I could have given you more, but...
Well, you've given us enough here to...
Yeah, this is terrific. We've gone on for an hour and a half now.
Well, great. All right, well, thank you very much, and I'll go back now to the practice of the law.